Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Monday, December 19th, 2022. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, asking you, as we are now in the midst of Hanukkah, and we are days away from Christmas, and we are days away from New Year's, or 11, 12 days from New Year's, to consider adding commentary to your list when you are thinking about your annual giving. Commentary is a 501c3 nonprofit. And to keep doing what we're doing, to present you with this podcast, to present you with the magazine, to present you with the website, we need your help and support. That is how we keep the lights on and how we keep being here day after day. We do and do for you people, as David Letterman once said. And every now and then I ask you to provide your support, and I would be really, really grateful if you responded favorably. And if you do so, please go to commentary.org/donate to do so. And with me, as always, executive editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Media commentary columnist and American Enterprise Institute fellow Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
And associate editor and author of The Rise of the New Puritans, Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So the border crisis is reaching levels so acute that a Sunday morning chat show on television this week with George Stephanopoulos devoted most of its running time to the border. An interview with Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, and interviews with people at the border and the like. Apparently, now that the election is over, you can no longer hide the fact that the border, things are completely out of control at the border. And this, Christine, bring us up to speed on the border.
Sure. Well, on Friday, which a lot of, again, Friday news dump, a federal appeals court said that the COVID-related policy known as Title 42 that was actually started under the Trump administration is going to end on December 21st, on Wednesday. Now, this is unless the Supreme Court intervenes, but that's, I think most people assume, not likely. This is something, Title 42's removal and expiration was something that immigration advocates have been arguing for. It allowed the administration to invoke COVID as a reason to just turn people away, send them back across the border because of the public health emergency. It is worth noting, again, the irony of the Biden administration not being too worried about a COVID-related policy ending if it helps the immigration, people come across the border, often illegally, but there's still a crisis if you're talking about student loan debt. So there, again, this is an ongoing contradiction in administration policy. But the real problem here is that this is going to lead to more influx, more asylum seekers, and the border has already been a longstanding crisis. So one of the things that the Biden administration has been effectively doing is preventing local officials from trying to declare any sorts of emergencies as long as Title 42 was enacted. They could turn people away. And the mayor of El Paso, who's named Oscar Leeser, issued an emergency declaration when he found out the Title 42 was likely to expire. So you now have officials at the local level declaring an emergency that for a very long time, both the administration and certainly its allies in the media have long sought to portray as just not that big a deal. Well, it has long been a big deal. We know that conservative media has been covering this for a while. But what the end of Title 42 means is that the border is going to evidently be open again, as the Biden administration officials like to say. Now, look, a lot of the people coming across the border are from countries where they might have a legitimate asylum complaint, political asylum, other things. But the crisis right now is that we do not have an infrastructure in place at the border to track and to process these asylum requests. And so what we've had are a lot of contacts with people coming across the border who then are released and disappear. And that's the last we hear of them. And we've had lots of people coming across the border in the last few years who fit that description. So this is ongoing crisis. It remains to be seen what the Biden administration is going to say and do about it. But this does change things a bit. And as you saw, John, during that report, there were asylum seekers from Cuba, from other places, who all know that this is about to expire and that this means that it will be easier to come to the border.
It's not just border towns. New York City's Mayor Eric Adams sounded the alarm yesterday.
put out a statement saying the city is not prepared for Title 42 to expire. The shelter system is full. We're out of money. We're out of staff. We're out of space. They've had all of 31,000 migrants this year since the spring. And they're putting a lot of blame on Greg Abbott for shipping a grand total of 3,000 migrants from the border to New York City and highlighting the disparities of enforcement at the border and elsewhere in the United States. But this isn't just a Republican problem. It's not just a border problem. His own allies are saying we can't stop doing this, which makes it sound like it shouldn't be a COVID policy, right? Because it's not a COVID policy anymore.
Yeah. Gavin Newsom's also complaining, right? Saying that the California can't absorb any more of this and they're going to be overrun. It's a weird, it's like that thing when the saying about how'd you go poor slowly then all at once. It's yeah. Like everyone was happy to sort of watch this happen until now, you know.
I've often said on this podcast and elsewhere that I am as dovish as a matter of sort of emotion and history and intellect and family history and all of that on immigration as you can possibly be. But one thing has always caught me up short when I was in debates with people about this, say, over the last 20 years, which is when they say, but, you know, look, we're a nation of laws. There are these laws about how immigration goes. And you're essentially saying that in this one area of law, there should be an acceptance that there is sort of mass disobedience and lax enforcement. And how can you stand with that? And it's a very interesting point. There is no argument against the idea that illegal immigration is illegal. And you can change the wording and you can come up with some semantic, you know, way of denying that the immigrants are in the country illegally, and that therefore they're not immigrants in the classic sense. But you can deny it, but it's true. And we face now this situation in which basically many, many, many decades of a world in which it was understood everywhere that if you just get in and get across, you were likely to be able to stay in the United States for the rest of your life. And the word, just like everything else in the world, the internet age and all of that makes it so that any message, the fact of this is now transmissible immediately and instantaneously everywhere at any point to anybody, such that on this broadcast yesterday on ABC, these migrants who were interviewed by the ABC reporter at the border all knew about Title 42. They knew its ins and outs. They knew when it was going to expire. They knew, you know, that since it was a COVID era restriction, it was coming to an end and maybe they could, you know, the remain in place policy wasn't going to stand and all of that. And so basically the entire country is outmatched. It's like, if you have these pressure points and you have hundreds of thousands of people who are pushing against a wall that doesn't even exist, they're going to break through the wall and the sheer numbers will overwhelm the system. I don't have an answer. Nobody really has an answer. And the Trump solutions, which were the first time, remember, Trump not only attempted to, you know, sort of stop illegal immigration, but he radically reduced the numbers of legal migrants or people who could come into the country over the 4 years. How did that work out? It didn't work out. That's dumbass, stupid policy based on hostility to the very notion of letting people into the United States. And nothing is working. So the remain in Mexico policy didn't really work all that well either, by the way.
Well, but
so that, go ahead.
But this is why the Biden administration actually does need to proactively say what its plan is and what, and if not, I mean, look, Congress needs to deal with this. But the reason the Biden administration likes to stay silent on anything related to the border is that they were happy to continue the Title 42 policy because at least it was a break that they didn't have to, they could say, well, it's COVID, we're just going to extend it. We love illegal immigration, but, you know, we just, this is all we can do in this crisis point. Well, now it's time. They can't kick that can down the road anymore. They've got to deal with it. The other issue here is it's not just about people seeking asylum who might get turned away unfairly. It's not just about people sneaking across the border hoping to stay here illegally. There's a massive drug crisis going on at our border and a lot of fentanyl and being smuggled in via Mexican cartels that are highly organized and using our porous southern border to bring a lot of stuff in that's very bad for everyone in this country. So that there are security and health and safety issues with regard to the border that have nothing to do with whatever new policies we need to devise. But it is time. And I think, you know, with a divided Congress and an administration that likes to look the other way anytime the border crisis comes up, it's unlikely to happen in the next session of Congress. But this is something that I think both Republicans and Democrats, the ones who care about immigration, have been beating the drum on. So we'll see if Biden actually has a response. I'm not hopeful because he tends to ignore this. But this is going to be a major election issue if it continues in the way it has before and the political stunts and all the stuff we've talked about in the past.
Doesn't this fall into Kamala Harris's portfolio? She was tapped.
She's worried about root causes. No,
that's right.
I mean, yeah, the actual border policies are a little complicated for Kamala. She's really concerned about it.
That was her staff, if I recall correctly. She was in March of 21. She was tapped to be, you know, the root cause person. Yeah. Go down to Central America and figure out what the push factors were and then try to address them there rather than actually enforcing the border. But if I remember right, it was her staff pushing back on this, knowing that this was just abuse of this poor woman, giving her this Gordian knot that she was not going to make any progress on. And then they were saying like, she's just a border czar, not really in charge of anything serious, just kind of like doing a lot of talking. But nevertheless, I mean, to take the administration at face value, this is part of her expansive portfolio of, you know, irresolvable conundrums.
Well, and it could be an opportunity for her if she was a different sort of political figure to actually start speaking out on this, to kind of be the person in the administration who comes up and floats creative solutions. I mean, Congress would still have to enact them. So even if they fail, at least she said something, but she is not that politician.
She comes from a sanctuary state. This is the ultimate, we have this ultimate problem, which is that the Democratic Party has all but explicitly in its materials and the way it handles this issue become a pure total open borders party. And then you have the Republican Party in response, which now doesn't even like legal immigration. So once again, you have this like almost astounding level of polarization on this issue that makes any kind of compromise all but impossible, as far as I can tell, because Republicans want the number to be zero and Democrats don't want there to be a number. Democrats have made this terrible category error of believing that activists with vowels at the end of their names represent the opinion of the rank and file people who are, you know, nominally considered Hispanic, and that the activists think it's the more the merrier, also because it gives them, you know, safety and power and numbers. And one of the reasons for the Republican surge in, you know, Latino communities is precisely that a lot of second, third, fourth generation Hispanics do not feel connected to these migrants and do not want things being done in their name that have nothing to do with them, and do have this simple fact, which is why this is such a potent issue for Republicans and why it's so dangerous for Democrats. There's just an elementary, there's a line, and everybody understands that you have to stand in line and take your number and wait your turn and all of that. And all of that is just broken down here. And it's not fair. It's not fair to the people who have been waiting in line. It's not fair to the people who do work hard and play by the rules and try to obey the legal system of the United States, which they wish to join. they are disempowered, and they are, you know, they essentially have this, one of the American political parties is effectively discriminating against them for following the rules.
Yeah. And it's, so it's not fair to these overwhelmingly Latino legal immigrants. I mean, they're the ones that are looking upon this and saying, what do you do? What are you doing? You're getting in front of me here. The part of the problem with it being so polarized, such a polarized issue at this point also, is that as long as you have the Republicans now sort of dead set against any immigration, as you say, as far as the press is concerned, there is no border problem, right? Because the Republicans care about it. The only border problem is that Republicans want policies that will be mean to people at the border. That's the problem that you can.
Right. Kids in cages. Part two,
right. Kids in cages.
Listen, if you are an editor at a major news organization, including at ABC or CBS or NBC or whatever, the disincentive to cover this in the way that you're talking about is very large. Like, you don't have an association of, you know, Hispanics and Latinos that is going to support you if you do, you know, a tough story on border enforcement. You do have activist groups that are going to yell at you, request meetings, are going to try to organize people on your staff to say that these stories are hostile and monstrous. You know, inside MSNBC, you know, you have Jacob Soboroff, who is basically just a kind of, you know, open borders activist, you know, weeping deep crocodile tears over the kids in cages and conveniently forgetting the kids in cages during the Obama administration and presumably whatever the kids in cages are during the Biden administration. And the kids in cages, by the way, one of the most offensive propagandistic formulations. The reason that this was how people were being held was to deal with the fact that it is hot in Texas and that it's the summer, and what you don't want to do is have people in enclosed spaces if you need to hold them temporarily and make sure that they don't run off, but you don't want to put them in buildings where it's going to be monstrously hot.
And worse than that, they were pictures from the Obama era that they were often using, claiming they were from the Trump era. And this policy has continued under Biden, and we haven't seen any of the same thing. So it was such blatant hypocrisy on the part of the news media that reported this as some sort of uniquely Trumpian
settlement.
Thing.
It's the Flores settlement that requires the detention of minors for brief periods while you process their
parents. For their own safety.
Right, exactly. It was what was offensive about the Trump administration was John Kelly, who was at the time DHS head, saying that this policy, which had been in place, is in place, requires congressional remedy to not be in place, was going to be punitive, was going to be used as a deterrent measure when it wasn't a deterrent. It never functioned as a deterrent. And it was somehow going to be used in a fashion that was not just complying with the law reluctantly, which is kind of the tone you probably should take. But it was just going to be a way to punish people who were coming across the border, which was offensive and wrong.
Yes,
frankly,
exactly.
Then it had the desired effect. The desire was to rally up, you know, rally their side against this issue and rile up the left. And, you know, it had its intended effect. It was a silly and rather crass thing to say at the time, but it wasn't a new legal policy.
It was, but you have to say that one of the unintended consequences of America being a compassionate nation in this regard is that there is no deterrent effect from, you know, in a world in which you have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people attempting to get into the country illegally. What's your deterrent against this wave of people? So if you transmit the idea, and it wasn't just Kelly, Jeff Sessions did it when he was attorney general. You try to scare people from not coming. It's like, if you come, we will take your children from you. If you come, we will do this, we'll do that. Like, don't come. Now, you can understand why that is. It is offensive to the, you know, is offensive to anybody's, you know, emotional spirit. And it is an offense against the whole notion of how the United States functions, but as a desperation play, you can sort of understand without it, what do you have? What's the risk? What's the threat to the people who come across the border illegally? The only threat or risk is the journey that they make or the possibility that they will be turned away again. But if they will be turned away and therefore all the hardship that they experienced getting to the border was for nothing. But if the theory is, if enough of us come at once and there are a million people waiting at the border, we can burst through. They can't process us in time. We will just simply, get on that bridge to El Paso and cross that bridge. And how are they going to stop us? Are they going to shoot us? We'll just, we'll be under the bridge and then we'll swim across the river. Like however it is you want to slice it. I feel like we can sort of understand why the deterrent idea was seductive and attractive to these guys who also obviously don't really care about the issue. That's why this is so intractable a problem. It's like a lot of these mores, and it's like, what if you test them, if you test a law, if there is a mass disobedience of the law, then you have a real crisis, because laws are partially there because people follow them and don't say, I'm not going to follow them. Like, what do you do? How do you enforce a law when you have 5,000 cops at the border and a million people and they can't shoot? You can't.
Well, even Obama said, don't send your kids. Can't keep track of them. Terrible things happen to them. God knows if they'll get back, if they'll survive, if they'll be kidnapped. Don't send your kids to the border. I mean, so.
Yeah, but now the message now from the Democrats is so far to the left of even that responsible messaging. Now it's no human being is illegal. Like, it's just it's so much like a sign that someone puts in their yard to virtue signal rather than any sort of semblance of thoughtfulness for the safety and well-being of the people who might be trying to come over here. Like, a lot of these people die. They die in the desert. They die drowning. Their children die. It's horrifying. And we obviously need to do something. But the idea that we should just have an open border, countries don't have open borders. This has been a longstanding problem in Europe. This is something that I think we want to feel good about ourselves as a nation and the kind of nation we are. And we are a nation of immigrants. All of us come from immigrants who came here often in desperate times, looking for freedom and opportunity. But you have to have a policy in place that allows for people to take their turn to come in when they need to. And not, as you say, John, the rule of law exists for a reason, and challenging it without any sort of pushback from elected officials who say, you know what, you can't, this is not the way to do it. And you're not hearing that from the Democrats now. And I think it's a huge opportunity for Republicans who actually want to do something responsible, but they too are beholden, unfortunately, to their kind of crazy right wing on this matter.
I mean, I think it's important that you invoke the rule of law, because that goes to what I was talking about, which is that the rule of law is only effective when people accept its legitimacy. And the problem with a circumstance like this is certain types of messages, like, just shoot them when they're coming across the border, will start sounding weirdly attractive to people because the rule of law itself seems to have broken down. And what is there besides the rule of law? There's just sort of naked aggression. Or frontier justice. Like, frontier justice is what you have before you have the rule of law, because there's no agreed upon standards. And if we have a, generations long system of scofflawery, the idea that rule of law, at least in this realm, has broken down, and that something else more elemental needs to come into play, will be more and more attractive as time goes on. Now, the American people in polling continue to be positively disposed toward immigration, not just legal immigration. I mean, they believe that immigrants are a net positive to the country. Like, in the 60s, the polling numbers are in the 60s consistently. that it's a good thing. Immigrants work hard. They, you know, they do jobs other people won't do. They do that, blah, 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 like all of that. This is not something where if we follow public opinion and if you have rational policy ideas, the public will not support, the public will support them because they also like law and they don't think you should break the law and all of that. As I say, the part, this is part of the brokenness of our political system, that this is where the center is, and almost no politician inhabits the center, which is we've got to figure out some way to stop this wave of illegality, and we also have to figure out a way to be welcoming to the people that we should welcome. With that, let me talk to you about Bambi. When running a business, your employees can create all kinds of interesting situations. Let me give you one. Like, somebody comes to you and says, person doesn't bathe, smells horrible. Like, how do you handle that? How do you talk to such a person and keep comedy in the workplace? You better talk to Bambi. With Bambi, you get access to your own dedicated HR manager starting at just $99 a month, available by phone, email, and real-time chat. So onboarding and terminations run smoothly, team members reach peak performance, and your business stays compliant with changing HR regulations. And with Bambi's HR autopilot, you'll automate important HR practices like setting policies, training, and feedback. They look, an HR manager could cost your company $80,000 a year. Bambi starts at $99 per month. Schedule your free conversation today to see how much Bambi can take off your plate. Go to Bambi.com right now and type in Commentary Magazine under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. Spelled Bambee.com, Bambi.com. Type in Commentary Magazine. So we're apparently going to have... No, what's the story? How is the January 6th stuff going to work this week?
Today, Monday, they're having their last hearing, as I understand it. And they're going to be issuing their final report, which we can all pore through, I think also later today, and issuing a set of recommendations for the Justice Department. Most analysis of which, preliminary analysis of which, suggests there will be criminal and civil referrals involving the president, maybe some people around the president, to the Justice Department.
So we're told that there may be as many as three recommended referrals to the Justice Department against Donald Trump personally for his involvement in the January 6th insurrection.
Those being obstruction of official proceedings of Congress, conspiracy to defraud the United States, and insurrection.
So how dismissible is this as simply as politics, do you think? Or here's what we have. We have the way that this has gone since the January 6th committee was established. I think I referred to it the other week as the Obi-Wan Kenobi play, which is, you know, you come after me, but the more I will be strong. You know, if you strike me down, I shall be stronger than you can ever believe. And that has been, terrible. You know, they're having this committee and they're having these hearings, and you'll see people are going to think it's just so unfair, and they're just like going after Trump and all this. And I think that attitude is demented. I think Trump has really been hurt. And degrade, you know, Trump's position among people who aren't in love with him has been vastly degraded.
Well, and we're going to
go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say we're going to get the details when the report is. I mean, this is what's interesting, right? So we've heard, you know, we heard some testimony. People didn't follow it granularly, but there's going to be, I assume, a lot more heft and background and documentation in the report about things like witness tampering, about pressure campaigns on the people who were called before the committee, and just all of the ways in which, all of the reminders of how Trump does business, whether as a businessman or as a politician or as a post-president, like everything about Trump that, as you say, John, people don't need reminding of right before the holiday season is going to be right out there to see again.
Well, the question that John asked was how much of this is attributable to politics? And even what we've been privy to, this is the eighth or ninth January 6th committee hearing. And if you've followed all of them, as I have, a fairly granular level, I think you could attribute political motives to not issuing referral to the Justice Department regarding obstruction of Congress, for example, certainly conspiracy to defraud the United States government. Insurrection, very debatable, high threshold of evidence there required for something like that. I think you could say that that's perhaps politics going against the president. It would be politics in the president's favor had they not issued these recommendations, because they would be making political considerations in the process of not issuing those referrals. They would be destabilizing to the American political compact. They might help Trump more than hurt Trump. Those are all political considerations outside the purview of the Justice Department.
So, Abe, where do you come down on this? It hurts him or it helps him? He's in this, obviously, very, Trump is in this very complicated moment for him, as his poll numbers have clearly cratered among Republicans. And now, even in polls where people are asked the open-end question, who do they want to be the Republican nominee in 2024? Open-ended, meaning they're not given a list of names to choose from. They are choosing DeSantis. This poll that was happened last week had DeSantis up by 12. That's a pretty staggering fact. And Pence wasn't even sort of anywhere in there. So DeSantis has clearly moved into poll position among rank and file Republicans who are being, who are being reached by poll, which means that they're being reached randomly. He is not in good shape right now where this is going. Does this trigger an autonomic defense response among Republicans where they go, they're after him again? Just let him alone.
A negligible one. But the thing about the crisis that whereby Republicans now feel constantly victimized is that it's endlessly repurposable. So you don't have to come to Trump's the stop the steal is so old. You can repurpose the same sentiment in all sorts of ways. The same goes for the paranoia. There are new conspiracy theories to latch onto. There are new wrongs to be avenged. And I think there's a big degree of boredom with even among those who had been sympathetic on the right. They're sort of bored with Trump's brand of that.
There's kind of some evidence for that in what Carrie Lake is doing.
Right.
So Carrie Lake's out there now saying she identifies as an election denier. This is a clip that I came across the other day. Her pronouns are and one.
It's so obnoxious and stupid.
It's so obnoxious and so provocative and just like really ham-fisted, chewing the scenery to a degree that like is just kind of generating eye rolls. I mean, obviously, Carrie Lake is no Trump just by virtue of her stature, not her performance art, which I think I maintain she's pretty good at. A lot of people disagree. Okay. But nevertheless, the message isn't finding a lot of takers. It's not generating the enthusiasm that you would expect it to if this was really a rallying cry for the modern Republican Party.
So my kids and I every year have the Christmas, what are Christmas classic movies in our household that we watch. And so last night we kicked off our viewing with National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, an amazing movie. And I swear to God, Trump is becoming Eddie, the weird brother who shows up in his tenement on wheels, RV, and like just inserts himself into what would otherwise be a sort of nice family gathering. And I feel like Trump and his folks are getting that reception more and more from people, not from the media, which wants to continue to give oxygen to his, crazy, which is because it's good for Democrats and good for the media. But I totally agree. The Carrie Lake thing, I actually just laughed out loud when I saw that. I mean, and she's actually doing the Stacey Abrams grift, right? She's got a website there that you can go and give her money. So now she's going to raise money for her, supposedly stolen election. So, I mean, this is now becoming, I guess, a kind of offshoot political grift that both Democrats and Republicans will now embrace after every election.
To torture the metaphor, Trump is emptying the RV's sewage system into our national sewer.
Perfect.
In a poorly closed robe.
There we go. Smoking a cigar while drinking a beer. Yes.
Waving the eggnog at us.
Good old Randy.
It is a great movie. Anyway, I was just thinking. Now I'm going to be self-referential and talk about my piece. Geopocalypse Now in the current issue of Commentary, available at commentary.org, because I throw out this idea of three concentric circles, that at the core you have the Trump base, the people who don't mind him shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue. And obviously they will be enraged and furious and disgusted and hysterical about whatever the January 6th commission issues today. And then you have the second circle, which is the Republican base, which threw in its lot with Trump. And then you have the third and much larger circle, which is the Republican Party as a whole, people who are much less politically engaged, are Republican voters because they, you know, fundamentally agree with the general tenor of the Republican approach, and don't like liberalism and all of that, but seem to be the people who either withdrew from their affection for Trump or never really had that much to begin with, but were fine with him or whatever. And the question then goes to how these circles will respond to January 6th, because the gut instinct will be the liberals are coming after him with the media and, you know, and the rhinos, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, and they're all just going at him. And, you know, he is the guy on the NFT with the lasers coming out of his eyes, and he must prevail. But I just don't know if those two larger circles, the Republican base and the base and the Republican Party as a whole, won't go, just enough already. Like, we've had enough. And what's more, some of this is disturbing. Like, some of it. Now, if they overreach, if the tone of the report is, you know, like Eric Swalwell, and is, you know what, he was insurrectionary, and let me just bring in Russia in here, just the site, you know, there's still many unexamined questions about him being a spy for Russia. Like, if that happens, I don't know, but if the report maintains the tone that the January 6th committee has struck the entire way, which again I think people on the right have underestimated as a really clever, it was a very brilliantly staged thing that they did. The way these hearings were structured, the way they laid out the evidence, the fact that they each hearing had its own theme and through line, so that it wasn't just different people getting up and yelling and screaming at witnesses or, you know, complaining, but that they were all sort of on the same page laying something out that was coherent and credible. If the report is like that, I don't know. It could be very down. It could really be another nail in Trump's it could be a very serious series of nails going into Trump's political coffin. And then apparently there's other stuff coming out this week on the tax case and things like that. Like, it's just, you know, it's not good. Things are not good for him. And the notion that they're going to be good for him because he's being exposed as somebody who might be indicted for crimes by the Justice Department, still don't want your person to be indicted by the Justice Department. I'm sorry, all things being equal, he doesn't want to be indicted, and his own people shouldn't want him indicted. Like, martyrology, you don't want to be a martyr. Well, you're a martyr unwillingly.
It's easy to be a martyr when the threat is vague or still just a threat, but once you're part of the legal process, it becomes a lot more difficult to play the martyr when you actually have to, you know, produce documentation for your side of the argument or to appear before a judge. I mean, that's where he always gets into trouble.
Right. Let's take a break and hear from our friends at FIRE. Do you know only 1 in 3 Americans believes we can fully exercise our free speech rights? That's why FIRE is stepping up to protect freedom of expression for all Americans, no matter where you're from or what you believe. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE, knows free speech makes free people. FIRE will always be a principled, nonpartisan, nonprofit defender of your rights. Join the fight for free speech at www.thefire.org. Okay, so we're going to say goodbye until tomorrow, because we are this week taping special holiday content for the Christmas week that we have to do immediately after each podcast this week. And so we're going to be a little shorter this week, and we're going to have these short podcasts next week for your listening pleasure. So we'll be back tomorrow for Abe, Noah, and Christine. I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.